The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
Live from Northern California, it's Lifeline with Craig Roberts. He's the host of Northern California's longest-running conservative talk show. He's a man with a message, a conservative with compassion. He's Lifeline's own Craig Roberts.
Welcome. It is the 12th day of March. We're just, what, 3 days shy of the Ides of March here? And with that thought in mind, we're going to dive into the Tuesday edition of Lifeline here. Lots to be talking about. And I think kind of appropriate to spend some time, at least in the first hour tonight, with an appropriate history lesson. The old adage, those who forget history are condemned to repeat it, perhaps serves as a important warning for this current generation. And, you know, largely because of the failure of many aspects of public education, a lot of people don't understand the complicated history of Europe and the reasons why the United States has not once but twice called upon to effectively rescue the continent. And undoubtedly, our last incursion there, critical to saving not just the continent, but perhaps the entirety of the free world. And we had our hands full in 1942 through 45, because it was not just dealing with the threat of the spread of Nazism across all of Europe, which had basically engulfed the entire continent by 1943, excluding, of course, Britain. And then, of course, Japanese incursion into all of Southeast Asia. People not even aware, perhaps, that on December 7th, when Pearl Harbor was attacked, there were simultaneous attacks taking place at the behest of the Japanese Navy and Army all throughout parts of Asia, Hong Kong, Singapore, North Korea, or all of Korea at the time. It wasn't divided at that juncture. And then, of course, the locations we're all familiar with from World War II history, Guam, Wake Island, the Marshall Islands, on and on the list goes. One of the important results of the outcome of the victory at the conclusion of World War II was both the foundation of the United Nations, which admittedly has been met with varying degrees of success and failure, though perhaps ideologically, in the purest form, not a bad idea. Please note I said in the purest form of the UN. And along with that, the foundation of the North Atlantic Treaty Organization. Now, in recent times, this has come under attack, seemingly an organization that has either outgrown its usefulness or become something entirely too unwieldy from a operational expense standpoint for the United States to continue to be involved with. So we thought, rather than debating this from a political standpoint, let's look at it from a historical standpoint. And why not reach out to an educator to do it? In fact, an educator who's also a author and a journalist. And oh, by the way, an attorney as well. Put them all together, what do you get? You get Joe Murray. He is, of course, the author of the best-selling book, Take Back Education. And Joe, is always a privilege to spend some time with you.
It is great to be with you, Craig. And I, when you said bippity-bop, I was ready to say boo right there.
No extra charge, folks, for the sound effects. They're free. So, Joe, let's not waste any time and get down to cases. I know that this is a topic that you have, in times past, spent some time studying and endeavoring to try to understand. And I understand that certainly from an American perspective, when we think about an organization that appears on the surface to to be uniquely designed to protect Europe, that anybody who knows basic geography looks at Europe and looks at the United States and says, well, what does this have to do with us? So let's talk about some of the history of the United Nations, why it was formed, why it's important, who the brand new members are of barely a week ago, and and also perhaps dive into the notion of when the organization, for its purest of purposes, was called into use, what was the only country to ever invoke that, and referring to Article 5? So with that said, I want to step out of the way. The blackboard teacher is yours.
All right, let's see if I can remember all this. We're going to test my memory. Well, to understand NATO, you have to understand what gave rise to NATO, and that, of course, was the Second World War. And when you had the conclusion of the Second World War, you had pretty much most of Western Europe was destitute. That is where the war was fought, and the Germans were ruthless in the execution of that war, leaving countries like France and Spain and Italy and most of the European continent in pure financial straits. And the United States understood. You know, it was funny because George Patton had pleaded. He said, let's finish this march. Let's go to Moscow and let's get rid of the trouble that's in Moscow. But the United States, for a number of political reasons, opted not to do that. So what we had at the end of the Second World War was sort of a stalemate. We had the Soviets taking the eastern half of Europe, and then we had the western half. And many, many in the United States and in Western Europe were fearful that if we did not do anything to help protect the people of Western Europe, that eventually communism would sort of spread and it would sort of slowly encroach most of the Western continent. And because of that, we created NATO. And it was a simple organization that was meant to basically keep the communists in check. And once we did that, we kind of had a kind of a stalemate, because everybody in Moscow knew that if you attacked the NATO member, that meant all NATO members were coming in. And of course, the Soviet response to that was the Warsaw Pact, which meant that if the United States or any of the NATO allies ever attacked a member of the Warsaw Pact, that meant everybody came in on that as well, which is one of the main reasons why the United States was not involved in the Hungarian Revolution. That is a story for another day. So NATO served its purpose, right? It did exactly what it was supposed to do. It made sure that communism did not expand into Western Europe. And that is sort of where we are today. Because if we look at it, it's ironic that the same people NATO was formed to kind of deter are now the same group of people that are causing a lot of the headaches, and that is going to be the Russians. But of course, it's for wholly different reasons. And did I leave anything out on that, Craig?
No, I think that sort of at the top tier, you know, here's a brief summary of what you're about to learn that hit all the highlights.
Yeah. And I think what we have to understand, too, when we talk about NATO is going to be an organization that is geared at deterring war, right? Deterring conflict. That is why we had it, because it was very possible that shortly, if you're going back to 1945, 1946, it is not inconceivable that we get thrusted into another war. A lot of people were on edge at this time as to what we were going to be able to do, because nobody wanted another war. But we recognized, especially in the United States, you know, stateside, that we could not allow the Soviets to expand. If we lost Europe, especially Western Europe, it would be detrimental to not only to the cause of liberty, but to the United States geopolitical purposes. And that is where we were up until the fall of the Berlin Wall. NATO did exactly what it was supposed to do, which was continue the Soviets. What happened with NATO, and what is sort of giving us the problem that we see today, is after the fall of the Berlin Wall, because all of a sudden things changed, because the Soviets were no longer in existence, right? That you didn't have the Soviets anymore. They were no longer that long shadow overarching onto Western Europe. You now had a Russian Republic that had been fragmented, that it broke up into the numerous many states that were there. You had Russia, of course. You had Uzbekistan and all the other stands that are there. And now what we had to deal with is, what are we going to do? Does NATO continue on? Do we disband NATO? How do we deal with NATO? Because if we're honest, the purpose of NATO was, it's a Cold War policy. It was to prevent the spread of communism. And I think in the 90s is where we ran into the problem, Craig. If we're going to really look at this issue, how we got here today, how we got here to with Vladimir Putin, you got to go back to the 1990s. And that is when President Bill Clinton decided to expand NATO to Latvia, Lithuania, and Estonia. These are the republics that are right there on Russia's door. Now, I'm going to take us back briefly, way, way back to even Napoleon. The one thing that the Russians had always feared, and the one thing that the Russians had always been burnt on, was they never had a buffer zone. Napoleon took advantage of it, Hitler took advantage of it, and they had really had suffered great losses by both men. They had their countryside, their people had been decimated by both Napoleon and Hitler, and they were always gun shy when it came to a buffer zone. So when the Soviet Union fell, one of the things that Mikhail Gorbachev and many others, such as Boris Yeltsin, had really wanted was to make sure that the West did not encroach on Russian territory, or territory that would have been typically Russian. And for whatever reasons, the American State Department, President Clinton, and many in Western Europe decided they were going to bring NATO to Russia's doorstep. And a lot of Russians, Vladimir Putin included, saw that as an act of opportunity. And it was an act that they knew Russia was down and out. They knew Russia had been licking its wounds right now. And at that point, the West came and took great advantage of that. And that is what kind of led to where we are today. Because if we're going to try to be objective about this, why did Putin choose Ukraine? Because Ukraine, whether or not we can go into the historical validity of it, but there's always been a connection between Moscow and Kiev. There's always been, historically, going back to the 700s, 800s. But what was Ukraine pushing for? It was pushing for NATO membership. And some believe that that push is what caused Vladimir Putin to kind of jumpstart the invasion, to invade Ukraine before it became a NATO member. Because if it had waited, of course, if you invade a NATO member, then you're going to have a complete world war. But that also now triggered places like Sweden and Finland to be like, whoa, we're kind of nervous now. We didn't want NATO before, but now we're looking at potential Putin aggression, and we need that assurance, because the one thing that we know is Putin will not, at least at this point, want to attack a NATO member, because, as you said, that's going to invoke Article 5, and Article 5 is basically what could cause a potential world war.
Now, I'm curious, from your perspective, Putin's fear of Ukraine joining NATO, was that more out of the notion that while there was a growing alliance against Russia, in a sense, including now a nation right on Russia's border, that posed a bigger potential threat later on down the road? Or was it the idea that, with rumors that Ukraine would like to join NATO and some countries beginning to warm up to the idea of permitting that membership, that Putin had designs on Ukraine all along, as he had in places like Crimea? He had already gone in and created trouble in Georgia years before that. And so that the move happened, the attack happened when it did, as sort of a preemptive action, knowing that if it took place prior to Ukraine being a NATO member, that support for Ukraine would be potentially questionable, whereas if he attacked Ukraine after Ukraine became a NATO member, that the response by NATO, including the United States, would be immediate and therefore would potentially stand in his way. Which, or is there another scenario in terms of the timing and the motivation that I'm missing?
I think it's kind of everything. It's a kind of a hodgepodge. It's a smorgasbord, so to speak. Putin and Moscow had always had their eyes on Kiev. Of all the Soviet republics that broke away, Ukraine has the most ties to Russia. It has the most history. And it goes back to dynasties intermingling, like I said, back in the 700s. So Putin has always wanted Ukraine. Now, we saw that when he moved on Crimea. He was slowly embarking on a campaign to take back the Ukrainian republic that he believes broke away. If we're looking at it from Putin's perspective, it would be like Florida leaving the United States and declaring its own country, or Texas, pick your state. And eventually Washington would want to bring that republic back. And that is how Putin saw Ukraine. And if we're looking at it from a geopolitical standpoint, the fact that the traction with Ukraine becoming a NATO member was really picking up, that the validity was there, that you had a lot of nations basically saying it was going to happen, if not right away, but in the immediate future, that is what sort of compelled Putin to act before it happened. Because even though he has become quite a saber rattler now, with the threat of nuclear weapons pretty much being dropped all the time now because of Putin, I think he understood that if Ukraine became a NATO member, he would not be able to make any move on it, because it would be too much for Russia to deal with. Russia might be able to deal with Ukraine, but Russia would not be able to deal with all of Western Europe and the United States. Now, hindsight being 2020, it looks as if the United States is quite over and stagnant, and now we have China eyeing Taiwan, and we have a lot of issues dealing with our own ability. We're sending weapons to Ukraine, and, you know, I was reading an article right before we came on the air, Craig, where there's a munitions factory out there in New Mexico, and they had to bring people that had been retired since the year 2000 in, because the munition lines had gone asleep. They'd gone dormant because there wasn't a need for them, especially after the Gulf War. And now we're cranking out so much military material, especially the munitions, that our own stockpiles are running low. So there's a whole lot at play right now, because I don't know if NATO is a mirage or NATO is a reality. And I think that's what Putin's trying to test right now. Now, do I think he is going to attack a NATO country? Absolutely not. But that's why he attacked Ukraine now, because it's not a NATO country.
Lots to unpack, and even more so as we continue our conversation today. Some of the historical background of the whys in the founding of NATO in 1949, and some analysis as to its need or lack thereof in 2024. Best-selling author, educator, and attorney, and journalist Joan Murray with us. We take a time out, back with more as Lifeline continues.
And now back to Lifeline with Craig Roberts.
Outmoded, outdated, malfunded. That is typically the objection that we hear to the existence of NATO, and more specifically on a continent other than the European continent. Not really our issue, not really our problem. I mean, after all, if Ukraine is attacked, or Russia decides that Ukraine is only a start, and that other neighboring countries like Poland or Finland or elsewhere would be to his desire, after all, that's over there, we're over here, not our problem. Or is it? Some insights with Joe Murray, who is, of course, both an educator, a journalist, the author of a best-selling book called Take Back Education, and an attorney as well. And as we sort of walk through this from a historical standpoint, you know, there's good reason to suggest American isolationism. It has been costly down through the years when the United States has either torn ourselves or pulled, allowed ourselves to be pulled into wars, or just thrust ourselves upon wars, be it a war on the European continent in 1914, in 1939, elsewhere. We know, of course, that seemingly post-World War II, there has never been a 20-year stretch of peace that we haven't been involved in some kind of military incursion somewhere through all those years. And so I guess the question comes down to, is this organization still appropriate? And if so, why do founding nations like Canada and the United States, so far away, insist that there's a vested interest in the United States or in Canada being participatory with NATO?
Yeah, I think that is a great question, Craig, because there's no denying that when the Cold War was in full swing, NATO served a vital interest to American foreign policy needs. But now, in the aftermath of that, with the success of the Cold War for the United States, the question becomes, do we want to engage or be a part of an organization that could throw us into a global conflict? You know, George Washington, in his farewell letter, warned Americans to beware of permanent entangling alliances. And I think the criticism from some on those on the right and the left is that NATO has become a permanent entangling alliance that is there that only to pull us into a war and not really give us any major benefit. But let's talk on the other side. What we have is we have someone in Vladimir Putin who we know is not the most stable, who we know has ambitions of recreating the Russian greatness that he has feared, he fears has been lost. So where will he stop? And if there wasn't a NATO, then would he continue into Poland and try to gobble up some of the old Eastern Bloc? These are questions we have to look at reality, because we know that the Russian Federation, as it stands right now, this Ukrainian conflict, while not going as easy as they thought, is starting to become somewhat unpopular at home. There are a number of people at home in Russia that are growing going uneasy with it, almost like, I don't want to say it's there yet, but it's almost like a Russian Vietnam. But that being said, Russia has seen some major uptick in its progress. It is now back on the offense. It is starting to gather and get more material. And as the Western nations sort of tire of funding this, then Putin realizes that all he has to do is wait it out. And where I think the million-dollar question is, Craig, is let's just do worst-case scenario and say that Putin takes Ukraine. Okay, will he stop there? I think most historians, I mean, myself included, would argue yes, because Putin got what he wanted. He got the breakaway republic before it joined NATO, and he would end it there. Now, Moldova is another country, another breakaway republic, that is on the potential name of the chopping blocks that he would get. Would he go after those republics that have broken away from the Soviet Union that are not in NATO? And I think they are fair game, Craig. The question is it a vital American interest for Putin not to have those? And I think that is where this debate is. I think most Americans are going to argue that it's not a vital U.S. interest whether or not the Russian flag or the Ukrainian flag flies over Kiev or over Moldova. And I think that is the selling point that I think many that are arguing for an increased presence in this war are having a hard time selling to the American people.
Let me touch on a couple of items, and for one, I'm going to reach way back in history to the 1970s, and an observation that was shared by Richard Nixon. Now, Nixon, for all of his foibles and flaws, certainly understood a lot about foreign policy, international relations. He had a tenure as not only a senator and a vice president, but of course served a term and a little as president of the United States. Nixon warned in the 1970s that, and this is well before the collapse of the Soviet Union, well before we had seen somebody like Putin come on the scene, that were the Soviet Union to collapse and become a place, an incubator, so to speak, for democracy, that the success of democracy would be critically important. Were it to fail, he opined, that it would create an environment where not necessarily a resurgence of communism would occur, but a despotic government seasoned by decades, centuries of Russian imperialism that might suggest that the failure of democracy in Russia, giving rise to a despot who might see himself as an individual who could capture not just the world stage, but his place in history as being the one to revive, in a sense, the old, if not Soviet, the old Russian empire.
Yeah.
It's a very stark warning, and a warning when you put the pieces together with all of not just history but current news, I think calls one's attention to the notion that while it might be an idea that Putin looks at this as sort of, okay, I'm going to get my crown jewel. It's like I've picked up a neat piece of real estate that I can vacation in. But with somebody like Putin, is he ever done? Is he ever satisfied? Being mindful that it's not just Ukraine. It's not just the Crimea. It's not just parts of Georgia. But there may be much more in which he would like to see rejoin in not necessarily a revamping of communist Soviet Union, but Putin's personal Russia. What do you think?
Yeah, I think, look, I mean, what's driving the Russian people and Putin right now is a sense of nationalism, right? They want to retain that glory that they once had. And, you know, it's like everything else. We romanticize the past, even if the past wasn't that pleasant. But if you look at Russia right now, it is not viewed on par with the other nations, which are mainly China and the United States, and it wants to be back in the game. So you're right. Putin is wanting to kind of rebuild and reclaim, because it was a sense of embarrassment when those republics were able to break away, right? It was a sense of dishonor. So Putin is trying to reclaim that honor by reclaiming those territories. Now, again, I think we'd be somewhat remiss if we didn't recognize that not only is Ukraine once a proud republic of the Soviets and and has historical connections to Moscow, it is also a natural resources, you know, gold mine. There's a lot of natural resources in Ukraine. So adding that to the Russian portfolio would not be too shabby. So I think, absolutely, I think the long-term strategy is for Putin to reclaim some of those breakaway republics in his mind. The question is, would he reclaim, or would he move on Latvia, Lithuania, and Estonia? And I think most people would say no, because they're NATO members. And that brings me back to that point where you so aptly talked about Nixon. Democracy did fail in Russia, and I think what happened was, because the West was so aggressive in moving NATO to Russia's doorstep, we alienated them. Because think about it, Craig, if we're going to put this from the Russian perspective, I'm not talking about Putin's perspective, I'm just the everyday Russian. We fought so long to free them from the chains of communism, and eventually we won that war. Reagan bankrupted them, and the Iron Curtain fell, and the Russian people were free. And rather than try to help rebuild them, which we did to a certain extent, we used it as an opportunity for some geopolitical advantages, and namely, like I said, Latvia, Lithuania, and Estonia. We brought them into NATO. There was no reason for them to come into NATO. There was no strategical reason. There was no vital interest reason for them to come into NATO, other than to say that, look, you've lost, and in case you forget about it, we're going to bring in these countries that are right on your doorstep, and we're going to make them NATO members so you remember you lost. And I think it was at that point in the 90s that, while Russia at that time couldn't do anything about it, we planted that seed of resentment. And that seed of resentment is now in bloom. And I think that is why we have someone like Putin. Because honestly, if you think about it, Craig, who did the Russians view more skeptical than the United States at the fall of the Berlin Wall? And that was the Chinese, right? If you go east of the Urals, right, all the land that the Russians took from the Asian people, the average age of a person of Russian descent east of the Urals is about 72 years of age. There aren't a lot of Russians east of the Urals, and there's a lot of resources. And who might be eyeing that is China. So we had a golden opportunity in the 90s to kind of leverage Russian kind of suspicion on Beijing and bring them into the fold, but we chose the opposite. Now what do we see? We see Moscow and Beijing running military drills. We see them viewing the United States as the common enemy. So I think 100 years from now, when historians and political scientists are kind of debating how we got to where we were with Russia at this time, I think we have to go back to the 1990s with NATO and the push for the early Soviet republics to become a member of NATO.
One of the big issues that we'll talk about when we come back is the sense of a lack of parity or lack of balance in here, that while some would claim it's outmoded, others outdated, we've certainly heard criticism simply saying, well, if all of the above is or isn't true, it certainly is malfunded. And therefore, there is a disproportionate amount of responsibility, weight, shall you say, upon some NATO members, while others are virtually getting off scot-free because they are, quote-unquote, not paying their dues. Let's talk about that next. A conversation with Joe Murray, a slice of history, a look into perhaps a warning of the future as we talk about the background of NATO, what it meant, what it means today, what it might mean in the future, were it to no longer exist. A timeout, back with more as Lifeline continues.
And now back to Lifeline with Craig Roberts.
All right, welcome back. History lesson and maybe a history teaching us a lesson about the future. Constitutional lawyer, educator, and journalist Joe Murray with us today. His book, by the way, called Take Back Education, is available through Amazon.com. We're talking about NATO, its history, its purpose, and whether or not it's outlived its utility or its use. I understand that one of the key aspects of NATO and its function from the very beginning is the notion of mutual protection, meaning this idea that an attack against one member state of the now 32 is considered an attack against all. At the core, the promise of collective defense, which certainly is quite meaningful for a smaller member nation. And I mean, there are nations that are as large from a financial standpoint, an influential standpoint, as the United States and certainly the United Kingdom and countries like France and Germany and Greece. And then there are other countries like Lithuania, Luxembourg, Montenegro, that are small countries, relatively speaking, and would have a near impossible task at trying to defend themselves from a attack by Russia. And so with that idea in mind, this sense of an attack against one is considered an attack against all. It is codified within Article 5 of the treaty. I'm curious, historically, has that ever been called upon? Has that ever been put into use?
Well, before I answer that question, I do want to, you brought up an excellent point on the type of countries that benefit from NATO that I want to just briefly address, because it's a great point that you brought up, Craig. The United Kingdom being attacked by Russia is far-fetched. It's not going to happen. Germany being attacked by Russia is somewhat far-fetched. It's likely not going to happen. The same with the United States. What is at risk is these smaller countries that would not be able to mount a defense against any major attack from any of the major powers in the world. And I think what we have to understand at this point is they have a vested interest in NATO. If you're from Montenegro, if you're from Lithuania, if you're from any of these places, everybody understands why you want to be part of NATO. Because you get the guarantee that the United States military is going to be at your front porch if anybody is trying to trespass on your property. So the advantage for them is as clear as day. But I think what many people in the United States are asking and throughout Europe is, what is the benefit for the United States? So let's just say Lithuania falls, right? What direct impact does that have on the United States? And that is what some folks are thinking, but let me kind of then turn the page. So what would be the counter to that, Craig? Well, we know what happened in the 1930s in Europe. Many of the world powers looked at Hitler and they looked at Germany and they said, oh, well, he's just going after the Sudetenland. That's no big deal. You know, they thought that that was part of Germany anyway. Oh, he's just going over this little piece of Poland. He's just going over this little piece of Austria, right? He's just reclaiming lands that were traditionally German. The risk you run when you allow other nations to aggressively take over independent nations is that sense of appeasement that when you finally wake up and realize that they weren't just trying to do something benign like reclaim territory that was rightfully theirs, it becomes now increasingly more difficult to beat them back. And I think that is where we are with Putin. Is he trying to mount a Napoleonic, a Hitler-esque campaign to start carving up Eastern Europe and potentially Western Europe and creating a Russian empire? Or is he just trying to reclaim land that he believed was Russia's that was unjustly taken away from him? My answer to that question, based upon the facts, is that the fact that he chose to invade Ukraine and not Lithuania, Estonia, or Latvia is evidence that he is not trying to take over all of Europe and that he would not attack a NATO country, that he was basically trying a what we would call in the legal world a crime of opportunity. Right, Ukraine was still naked and vulnerable for a lack of NATO protection. It was about to become impenetrable with NATO protection eventually down the road, and for that reason he struck. So to answer the question that you also talked about too, what purpose does NATO now serve? Does the United States have a vested interest in NATO, and should the United States be concerned if countries aren't paying the amount of money necessary to protect all of NATO's interest? And I think these are all things that are very much on the table. I think the American people have to decide what they want to do in this next decade. Do they want to continue NATO, which is arguably a Cold War relic, or do they want to kind of redesign it and kind of make it a little bit different, still have it, but make it different? And the other question is, and I know I'm going a little bit down the rabbit hole, is let's say the United States withdraws from NATO, okay? And let's just say, for argument's sake, the United States tomorrow wakes up and says, we're not going to be part of NATO. Do you think that the other European nations would automatically, well, call it quits and run? I don't think so. I think they would probably still keep a military pact amongst themselves, but then they would have to pay a little bit more. So I think what we're seeing as the United States is coming to grips with some a lot of domestic issues at home, that foreign commitments, especially foreign commitments that have no tangible benefits to the United States, are fair game. Now, what we do with them, of course, is to be determined, but I think it is actually a healthy part of our democracy that we're at least questioning those things right now.
Well, and several thoughts that come to mind. I mean, number one, while certainly valuable, I think, to question, particularly when it comes to our expenditures anywhere, given our, you know, $30+ trillion deficit right now. At the same token, we have solid history as to what a Europe on fire looks like, not only in terms of the impact for the world, but the impact directly for the United States. And, you know, try as we wanted to, we were not able to stay out of World War One. Try as we wanted to, we weren't able to stay out of World War Two. And the world should be happy that we didn't, because if it weren't for U.S. involvement, you know, everybody on the continent today would be speaking German. That said, I think there's a sense of balance here, and that is that, you know, we've historically been the world's sort of harbinger of democracy, and I have to wonder how much risk we run if we pull back from that, and not only in terms of risk to other democracies around the world that we claim to want to support and encourage, but even our own sense of peace and well-being.
No, I think these are valid points. I think the United States removed from the world stage leaves a very dangerous world stage. And I think most people would agree with that, because since the United States became a country, we have become, as Reagan said, that city upon a hill, that light. And if that light starts to dim, then the world becomes a dramatically different place. I think what we're looking at is that when the NATO of the 1940s and the 1950s is not the NATO of the 2020s, you have a number of economies in Europe that are economic powerhouses: Germany, France, England. So the question becomes, do we want to kind of revisit the commitment of NATO? And I think it's a valid question, too, to say, do we want to revisit Article 5? If Putin, for whatever sense, decides to invade Lithuania, should that automatically trigger the United States into a global world war? I think these are valid questions. Now, of course, if Putin decided to attack, say Spain, I think that might be a different ballgame. I think these are valid conversations to have, and I think President Trump, unfortunately, kind of stepped in it when he attempted to have that conversation, but made it seem like he was inviting Putin to basically do whatever he wanted in Europe. Because you are right. History proves if we allow Europe to burn, the United States will eventually pay the price. So it's in our vital interest to try to prevent and make sure that those things do not happen. Unfortunately, though, I think in the political climate that we're in right now, we're not having that thoughtful discussion. It's basically an all or nothing, where we all know that in this world that we all live in the gray, not the black and white.
Let's pause on that point. We're going to come back to some closing thoughts and a couple of ideas as well. And we'll take a time out, come back to more as this edition of Lifeline continues.
And now back to Lifeline with Craig Roberts.
All right. Home stretch of this segment of the show here tonight on this Tuesday. Joe Murray, best-selling author, educator, and lawyer with us today. We're talking about some of the history of NATO and the need or lack thereof. One of the issues related to putting of Article 5, the attack against one is an attack against all clause, has been, in fact, put into action only one time since 1949. Interestingly enough, the country that it was put in action to benefit was not a European country at all, but in fact it was the United States following 9/11 and the ally members of NATO coming together to go against the Taliban and deal with the problem that had emerged in Afghanistan. So it has come to use. I think the big question is the issue of the parity in terms of fees. And maybe that's the problem, that in reading through the charter, there aren't actually dues. We've heard the phrase about this country that's not paying their dues, when in fact it's simply a recommendation as to how much they ought to invest of each individual country's GDP of 2%. Not all do it, but I guess you have to look at also in terms of the total dollar amount. You may have a country that may be a huge economic powerhouse that nevertheless may not be committing 2% to their defense spending, but still contributing a significant amount of money. Does it make sense to revisit that and codify the obligation as opposed to just it being a quote-unquote recommendation, Joe?
I think so. I mean, and you're right. I think when 9/11 hit and Article 5 was used by the NATO allies to make sure that Afghanistan would not remain a safe haven for terrorists, they did come to the United States defense. And I think when we look at NATO, again, I go back to Washington, because George Washington, in that farewell address, he had some really golden nuggets of information, you know, one of which was beware of political parties. And I think you and I can both agree. He also said beware of entangling alliances. I think any alliance that puts the United States in a permanent situation is always something that should be suspect. I think that we should always revisit and see, does this alliance serve our purpose? And if so, what should be the terms of the alliance? So NATO itself, I think most people would agree, is a great construct. It's a good idea. But like you said, okay, if we have nations that aren't paying their fair share, and I think you're right, when we look at some of the nations out there, we can't expect some of these smaller nations to possibly put up 2%. But then you look at France, and you look at Germany, and you look at some of these other countries where they should be taking more of a lead, right? NATO was created because there was no nation that could lead in Western Europe. They had been basically devastated by the Second World War. That's not the case now. There are a number of nations who could pick up the mantle and lead. So I guess the question that we have to ask as Americans, should the United States be the primary funder and the primary person or nation in NATO, or should we still remain a member but pass that torch to someone that's closer to home? And I think that's a valid question.
Lots to unpack, Joe, and undoubtedly we're going to be hearing more about this because there are valid questions that certainly do need to be addressed in terms of perhaps what a more modern NATO looks like and what true fairness or parity would resemble across the board. Final question, with the addition of Sweden now as an official NATO member, what is your reaction if you're Putin watching this?
I don't think, my own personal take on this by looking at the history of this, I don't think Sweden or Finland is going to be Sweden, of course, I don't think Putin really cares too much about. Finland, I don't think Putin will care too much about because there's no real desire to expand into Finland. Where I think it will be an issue is it's going to be when you talk about situations such as the old Republicans, Republics. I think that's where it's going to be. That's going to be the problem. So I don't think Sweden or Finland are going to have an issue. I do think what's going to be an issue is how we deal with these old breakaway republics in the near future.
Lots to consider, no doubt. Joe Murray, always appreciate your time helping to us to broaden our understanding, deepen our awareness of history, and hopefully challenge our thinking a bit as well. Joe's best-selling book, Take Back Education, available online through Amazon.com. Joe Murray, Joe, as always, thank you so much for the time. 6 o'clock from KFAX.
3-star General Michael J. Flynn, head of the Pentagon Intelligence Agency, knew all the government's dirty secrets.
He was one of the most respected generals in the military.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to. He understood its funding.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
The explosive new documentary, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, and covers the facts behind this scandal.
Flynn told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire.
I find out the worst enemy that I'm going to face in my life is right here in America. They took my assessment and they wanted me to change it. And I was like, I'm not changing it.
They had to get rid of Flynn.
With in-depth interviews, archival footage, and never-before-seen personal records of the man behind the headlines.
I just felt like I was drowning.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.